Governor Rauner, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen gathered this morning in Chicago to announce an ambitious partnership among our major universities and businesses called the Illinois Innovation Network. Here's President Killeen.
You know, speaking personally, this is what the state needs to build its tax base up. We need to take advantage of all of our assets. And most important among those are the human capital assets that we have for our talented youth.
But first, all of our medical advances rely on scientific research. But what if the way we're going about that is all wrong?
I think a lot of people go into science out of a sense of wonder. But what happens in science in particular is people feel the career pressures. And those pressures are different from just sort of exploring and understanding fundamental biology.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris joins us to talk about his new book, Rigor Mortis. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Think about the last important scientific study you heard about. Maybe it was about drug use or eating habits or your kids. Now think about the fact that it could have been wrong. That's the issue at the heart of the new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hopes, and Wastes Billions by Richard Harris. That name would be familiar to many of you listening. He's a longtime science correspondent for NPR. Richard's actually in Urbana for an event that's taking place later this afternoon at the University of Illinois. We're going to be tweeting out that information if you are in the central Illinois area and would like to attend that event. Follow 21ST Show. We'll also have it at our website, 21stshow.org. For those who can't make the talk, we're going to be speaking with him now. He's in our studios in Urbana. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, Richard, you start this book with a story that I found kind of shocking. You call it Begley's Bombshell. Can you share that story with our audience?
Sure. Glenn Begley was the head of cancer research at Amgen, which is a major drug company. And he'd been there for a decade, and he decided it's time to do something else. But before I leave, he decided he wanted to go back to revisit some of the studies that had crossed his desk over the years he was there. Drug companies like Amgen basically rely on academic scientists to come up with fascinating discoveries, which they publish in the scientific literature. And every now and then, those can be leads for new drugs, cancer drugs. And Glenn Begley had identified about 53 studies that he thought, well, if these studies had actually panned out, if these results turn out to be true, these are all really promising leads for cancer drugs. But he couldn't initially get them to work when scientists at his company tried to replicate the results. They couldn't. So he took another run at them and looked at them very carefully and even enlisted the help of some of the scientists who'd done the original research. And what he discovered and published was that of these 53 studies, even with the help of the scientists who'd done the studies to begin with, he could only get 6 of them to replicate. And that's, 11% success rate. Pretty shocking number, and similar, actually, to the results from the Bayer drug company that had done a similar experiment just shortly before Begley had, and they found a 25% ability to replicate study. So this was published a few years ago, and it raised a big red flag in biomedical science. How much of what we're producing actually is reliable enough that other scientists can replicate it? And that was a really big wake-up call.
And was it a wake? How? When was it a wake-up call for you? What was your motivation to writing this?
I had been, actually, when this paper was published, I was covering the environment at that time, a lot, climate change and related topics. But at the beginning of 2014, the science editor at NPR said, it's, time to play a little musical chairs, and would you go back and cover biomedical research? And I said, sure. It's been a decade or so since I had covered those topics in detail, but I wanted to sort of get myself back up to speed on what had been going on when I was off doing other things and not paying a lot of close attention to biomedicine. And what I discovered, first of all, was that things were not in great shape financially for the whole biomedical enterprise in this country. The NIH budget, which funds most of this university research, had doubled between 1998 and 2003, which was fabulous for science, and a whole bunch of new people went into the area. Laboratory space at universities increased ultimately by about 50% across the country. But then in 2003, Congress said, okay, we've done enough of that. Let's put our funding attentions elsewhere. And so NIH funding was basically held level, but in real dollars, in spending power, the spending power decreased by about 20%. So this was creating a huge problem for scientists, creating essentially a hyper-competitive environment to scrape after what little, you know, the funding that was there. Many, many people arguing for a smaller and smaller pie. And so I looked at that, and I looked at the Begley study, and I realized, I bet these things are related. And I did some reporting about that for NPR initially, and then I realized, you know, there's a lot more to this story, and I took a year off to write the book.
And there is a lot more to this. It's not just about money. It's about biases. It's about research methods. It's about the scientific method. I want to get into all of that. But I think the main point of this book is also just about the culture of biomedical research. And in your book, you argue it doesn't have to be this way. You say that the culture needs to be changed. And I was surprised to read that many scientists were eager to talk to you about that. Were you surprised about that?
I absolutely was, because I thought, you know, this is science not working exactly right at all. And actually, a working title for the book was Science Friction, the idea that this is friction that is slowing down the progress in science. It's not that progress has stopped. It most certainly hasn't. Still, a lot of stuff is published that's good, and the process is moving forward. But the reality is there are quite a number of issues confronting the biomedical research world. And I thought, you know, they're not necessarily going to want me to air their dirty laundry. But in fact, I found that many, many scientists were concerned about these issues, and not only concerned, but, you know, they did the right thing. They stood up and say, we need to talk about this. We need to, you know, get a discussion going. And that's how we're going to address these issues. And so I was actually welcomed as a person to conduct that conversation, to move it forward.
I'm speaking with NPR's science correspondent Richard Harris. We're talking about his new book that just came out a couple months ago. It's called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hopes, and Wastes Billions. If you have questions or want to join our conversation, as always, you're welcome to. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet. Our handle is 21STShow. Richard, you know, I was diagnosed with breast cancer earlier this year, and I can't tell you how many times my oncologists have cited studies to me, and I ask them for studies, and I read the studies, and I feel like practically everything from my treatment, and I think this happens not just with cancer, but lots of things, is all research-based. It's all studies and data. And I wonder, I mean, my impression of being in this world for the past couple of months has been that doctors treat studies like absolute truth. Do you get that sense also?
I think that it depends what kind of studies you're talking about. I think that there are I think that is one of the messages from this book. And I think scientists internalize this to some extent. I think deep down they know that they shouldn't take everything literally that they read. And I think that scientists do try to say, well, I'm not so sure about this one or whatever. But yes, I mean, that is the coin of the realm, right, as a study. And that's if it's correctly constructed and carried out well and reported correctly, that's how science advances. Studies are really important. And scientists do rely very heavily on them. I do want to draw a distinction between studies that are the focus of this book, which are called preclinical research, which is mostly research in animals and cell lines and so on like that, where sort of the ideas are generated from and where people are trying to understand the basic biology of cancer and so on. I want to point out that that's really where I'm focusing my attention. And the studies that the doctors are talking to you about, largely, I assume, are studies about, you know, about actual human experiments with drugs and where a drug has been tried in hundreds of people or maybe more, and the results from that guide their decisions about under what circumstances do we offer what drugs to what people and so on. And those studies actually are much more reliable than the preclinical studies that that are the focus of my book. And that's because they have to jump through a lot more hoops. These are, you know, my studies are the original ideas, these sort of inspirations that should form the foundation for these other studies. And very often what happens is someone picks them up, they say, oh, is this going to work? And 9 times out of 10, actually, they fail. They don't go anywhere at all. And it's the 1 in 10 that then moves forward and becomes a potential drug for human beings. And those drugs are tried, and a few of them are approved. But there's a much more rigorous process for that, because those studies are reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. They are scrutinized with a great more care. Sometimes there's still, a first approximation, and further studies show that actually it didn't work out the way we thought they did. But at least by the time a drug is on the market and doctors are proffering them, those are more likely to be actually solid results than the kinds of studies that I'm focusing on in my book, which actually, if you look at about half of those studies that are published, actually may not be replicable. About half the studies on further reflection don't go anywhere.
And so this may seem like a basic question, but why is a study being replicable important?
Well, the question is, there are so many variables, so many ways to go wrong, even in the best science and the best experiments, that the first question is, is this a real result, or was it a fluke? And flukes happen a lot. People make very basic mistakes. I talk in my book about the fact that many animal experiments, for example,
if you use male mice,
right?
For example.
If you have to think about the sex of the mice you use, or another common thing is scientists may have get a bunch of mice for their study, and they won't say, okay, who are siblings, and the siblings shouldn't all be put in one group and another group of mice put in in the control group, because then maybe the difference is just because is the difference between the genetics of the mice, and it has really nothing to do with the whatever intervention drug or whatever you're testing on these mice. So there's many, many ways to error, if you will, or to err, if you prefer to pronounce the word that way. And the whole process of science is basically, Richard Feynman, a famous physicist, put it nicely. He said, really the whole point of science is methods to avoid fooling yourself, because you're the easiest person to fool. Scientists, like the rest of us, get enthusiastic and about an idea, and they start seeing what they want to see. And the scientific method, when applied correctly, is all about filtering that out, so people are not just sort of suffering from wishful thinking, but they're actually getting results that are meaningful and not just confirming what they were hoping to see in an experiment.
That's Richard Harris. We're talking to him about his book, which is about, as he's saying, this sloppy science. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions as well to 21STShow. Let's go to a call, Paul in Urbana. Hey, Paul, welcome to the 21st. Richard was just talking about the scientific method. That's your question, right?
Right. Well, there's a broader philosophical thing, but I don't think it's good for your show, but I just wanted to throw out Thomas Kuhn and Paul Feyerabend and epistemological anarchy. But I specifically wanted to ask about if he thinks that maybe the scientific method, being able to replicate things, et cetera, is distorted by corporate influence to a great extent. There's a lot of non-transparency. There's a lot of private proprietary research that's going on. Is this a possibility that this is part of the distortion?
Part of the problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for that question, Paul. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. That is certainly one of the many influences that are at play here. And sometimes it can be a very significant influence. I will say that the Glenn Begley's study, which we talked about at the top of the hour, where he tried to replicate these 53 experiments. In the end, he wouldn't even say what the 53 experiments were, because he was sworn to secrecy by the scientists. He said, I want to try to replicate your study, but if it turns out to be embarrassing, I won't tell you. I won't admit who it was. So as a matter of fact, his study is not. Can't be repeated either, because nobody knows exactly what the studies were. So yes, that's clearly an element of what's going on here. I think that's part of the role of the FDA, also the Food and Drug Administration, is to make sure that they do have sort of inside knowledge of some of this proprietary information. And we have to rely on them to treat it honestly and to evaluate the studies and to ask those questions. Is this just, you know, a study designed to convince us to sell a drug that's actually not going to be any good at all? So there are steps checks and balances around that, but it's still clearly, human nature is a pressure on this. Wishful thinking is a pressure on this, and commercial interests are a pressure on this as well.
Richard, we just have about 2 minutes before we take a break, but I wanted to ask you just a follow-up about drug companies, because what surprised me in reading your book was that actually pharmaceutical companies are actually seeming to do better about this in terms of transparency and also making sure that their research is something that can be replicated, because there's so much money involved. So they are much more, it seems like, a little bit more careful and have more money than, say, academic institutions.
Right. Well, their economic incentives are very different. If you're a scientist, what you really want to do is have a paper that you can publish that says, look at this exciting thing I found. And actually, your reward is for publishing that in a big journal like Nature, Cell, or Science. And that's your primary reward. It can give you promotions and grants and this and that and the other. If you're a pharmaceutical company, though, your reward is actually finding a drug that actually you can ultimately sell for large amounts of money. So their incentives are much more, this has got to be right, or we're not going to pursue it. And that's why Amgen tries to run through these things and says, we're about to spend $100 million maybe developing a drug. Is this, in fact, something that's worth spending that money on? So the incentives are different, and as a result, they think more carefully about how real the results are.
We're speaking with Richard Harris. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with him. He's a longtime science correspondent for NPR, so this voice would be familiar to many of our audience. We're talking to him about his new book that came out earlier this year. It's called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hopes, and Wastes Billions. You can join our conversation as well. Tweet to us. Our handle's 21STShow. We're going to take a short break. If you just stay with us on the other side of this, we'll continue this conversation with Richard Harris. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Richard Harris. We're talking to him, NPR science correspondent, about his book, Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hopes, and Wastes Billions. Basically, what happens when scientific research is just not done well. And it happens more often than you think. We're talking specifically about biomedical research. Richard, just before the break, you mentioned something that I wanted to get into. You talked about the distinction between the research that pharmaceutical companies are doing in academic research. Scientists, it's an interesting theory that you write about in your book, that scientists, particularly in academia, are not rewarded for looking back or for failures. And of course, we all know the phrase publish or perish in academia, describing the pressure that researchers have to get their work published so they can advance their careers, especially when you're in sort of that postdoc phase, how important it is to be in a big name journal to get tenure and to have a job. How much does that contribute to the sloppy science that you have been reporting on?
I think it actually contributes quite a lot. And it's all about incentives, right? And so if your incentive is to be published in Science, Nature, or Cell, you're going to that your study has to be squeaky clean, has to be an amazing result. If you have too many outliers that you can't really explain. That means you're less likely to get it published. And so the incentives are all stacked up for scientists to do things that they may not. It may not be a conscious decision at all, but people respond to incentives, and they realize, well, gee, if I can, you know, I did that experiment six times and it worked once the way I wanted it to work, and that's the one I'll report, and that supports my conclusions or whatever. Those sorts of things happen all the time, just because of, we're human beings, and what makes this situation worse is the fact that there are so many people in biomedical research right now, and the funding is tight, and it is hyper competitive. And if you want to, you know, if you're a postdoc working in a laboratory, chances are if only 20% of them are going to be able to go on to do a real academic career. And that's going to be determined whether you can step out beyond that is whether you do get a high-profile publication in just a couple of years when you're a postdoc. And so the pressure, you can imagine, is enormous. And it also means that you're not necessarily choosing – you want a flashy result, but you're not necessarily taking a really big risk on something that might fail utterly, because if it fails utterly then you're completely stuck. But those are some of the most interesting questions, those sort of the long shots that can have big payoffs. So it's not just affecting people and their careers in science, but it's affecting the kind of science they do, the kind of questions they ask, and the kind of value that research provides for us. I mean, we need some big, exciting advances to deal with cancer and many other conditions where there's still a lot of unknown issues to resolve, and lots of stuff that we got to sort through. So it not only affects the people in science, but we feel the results of it as well as citizens.
And you write about this in the book, and in particular, you write about glioblastoma brain tumors. I wanted to ask you about that, but let me first ask you about Lou Gehrig's disease, because there's a heartbreaking story you have about an experiment that was just designed badly. Can you share that story?
Yeah, and not just one experiment, actually a whole bunch of experiments. ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, is a terrible disease of people's once you're diagnosed with this disease, usually often in your late 50s or whatever, you get progressive muscle weakness until you ultimately don't have the muscles to breathe anymore. So it's a really horrible way to go. And there have been many, many attempts over the years to come up with drugs to treat this disease. And almost nothing has been any benefit at all. And there have been many, many studies that have you know, seemed promising at the outset. And the reason they seemed promising in many cases was these drugs were tested in mice, and they seemed to work really well in mice. And so people say, oh, this works great in mice. We're going to try it in people. And so people get basically one chance at an experimental treatment, and many of them ended up in these experiments that went nowhere. And a group up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called the ALS Therapy Development Institute, decided to go back and take a hard look at those mouse studies that were causing sort of the initial trigger for many of these drug treatments. And when they redid those mouse studies, well, first of all, they noticed that the mouse studies were often done with a very small number of mice. They weren't carefully controlled. And the results, even though they looked really great in mice, it's like no one should have taken those results to the bank. And they redid these experiments for about half a dozen or so or more of these drugs correctly with mice doing all, you know, taking all the due care, getting large groups of mice, making sure the genetics are right, splitting up littermates, doing all the things you need to do to do an experiment correctly. And they found when they did the experiments correctly, essentially none of those drugs or almost none of them showed any promise at all in treating ALS. And the catch was each one of those experiments cost well over $100,000. And many academic scientists, of course, are very hard-pressed to come up with that much money to do an experiment. So they will often do an experiment with a small number of mice. They'll call it a pilot project, and they'll cross their fingers and say, you know, we got this nice result in our pilot project. Let's hope that it would apply if we actually did this experiment with the full set of mice and everything else. So that's where things stand with ALS, unfortunately. And actually, that episode of a run of those drugs is what drew attention to some scientists at the NIH that, hey, wait a second, this preclinical research isn't delivering what we expect it to. And we're putting out tens of millions of dollars to do studies that really don't have the right scientific backing. And so that study really, or that series of studies really did help refocus attention on this issue some years ago.
Right. And that helped refocus attention on particularly for ALS, because you talk about this in the book, how much they organized and kind of made sure that they had a lot more rigor that was applied to their science, to their research. You mentioned mice, and I wanted to go back to that just because you have a whole chapter on mice. And there's, by some estimates in your book, in the U.S., about 10 million animals, mostly mice, that are being used for research. Are there better alternatives?
There may be, in some cases, better alternatives. Clearly, if you just assume that a mouse is a small, furry human being, you're misleading yourself. And mice have sometimes been used without fully recognizing that, I mean, you can't extrapolate directly. And one of the things I explore in the book is, are there alternatives? And I think mice still serve a valuable function in particularly in determining whether a drug is safe or not safe, because mice may not be like us in all respects, but as a general rule, they are useful for identifying toxic drugs and hazards that we should avoid. We shouldn't risk putting them in human beings. But there are people exploring other ways of trying to understand the biology better, whether it's this bizarre and interesting technology called organoids, which are little small balls of cells that you can that grow, and you can sort of take a little organoid that's a sort of a makeshift human liver out of human liver cells, and you can do experiments with that. There are organs on a chip which are related to that, where you take organs, for example, I was in a lab that they had lung tissue. They put onto a small plastic chip, and actually, amazingly enough, the cells organize the way they organize in a human lung, where you have the little wavy fingers called cilia that help move particles out of your lungs and keep your airways open and so on. Those actually spontaneously organize and work together and so on. So there are some very intriguing ideas for moving beyond the animal experiments into human cells in the laboratory that are more realistic than your sort of standard cell culture. These are early days. Again, it's hard, you know, it's always easy to get enthusiastic, and certainly talk to people who are working on that stuff are highly enthusiastic, and I certainly hope that their enthusiasm is warranted. But it's also a time to recognize that we need to be really careful, because runaway enthusiasm is one of the ways that people can get results that don't stand up over time.
Right. And so there's runaway enthusiasm. There's lots of different biases, whether that's observer bias or publication bias. You spoke with some of the nation's top biomedical researchers and asked them what needs to happen to help fix all of this. What did you hear from them?
No surprise that there's no single fix that you could magically wave your wand and institute. I think obviously scientists have always said, oh, just give us a lot more money and then this hyper-competitiveness goes away. But I think they also recognize these days that's not a realistic solution to the problems. So people have been thinking a lot about how to move beyond this. And one idea is transparency. If you are much more open about what data you share, once you publish your study, if you also make your data readily available, other people can easily go in and check it. They don't have to waste months in the laboratory trying to replicate it. If the first step they try is to just reanalyze your data, and if they decide that your conclusions aren't supported by that, then that saves them a lot of time and effort. I think it's also true that just knowing that your data are going to be transparently available to other people may make scientists be a little bit more careful about how they handle their analysis and double check and so on. So that's, I think that's part of the solution is to increase transparency in that way. I think also to rethink how scientists are promoted. Right now in many academic institutions, the deans will count how many papers you have published, and they'll look how many are in these high-profile science journals. And that's driving people to publish a lot of papers and to try really hard to publish in Science and Nature and Cell, which may not be the best venues in many cases for these studies. And so if you can change the incentives for promotion and the expectations at an academic institution, that can also help reduce the pressure on scientists to do, you know, to produce data that are larger than life. And you know, there are other ways to go, but I think those are two ideas that are bubbling along right now that I think are intriguing and can make a significant difference.
And when we talk about what's lost here, obviously there's a huge medical cost to people who are dealing with terminal illnesses or chronic illnesses that have not been, their advances have not been made yet. And then there's the financial costs of this, right? The U.S. spends about $30 billion a year funding biomedical studies. You point out in the book, the average American household spends about $900 a year to support biomedical studies. Do you worry that, I wonder, especially in this climate of talking about science and the government and so much of a scientist making the case during the Trump administration that they feel like science is not valued. Do you fear that the case you make in your book that so much taxpayer money ends up sometimes being wasted on sloppy science might make people feel, well, we shouldn't be spending so much federal money funding scientific research?
Well, that would certainly be completely the opposite conclusion from where the book lands, because obviously this is being driven by the hyper-competitiveness. And if you reduce the amount of money available, all you're going to do is increase the amount of hyper-competitiveness and make these problems even worse. I think obviously it came along at a time when scientists may not be thrilled about talking about these issues. But the solution really is to make the simple steps that you can make to check your cell lines and make sure the cells are what you think they are, to be more careful about using antibodies in your research and so on. There are lots of things that can happen on across all levels, and that's where the productivity and the improvement is going to come. Science is an imperfect process, and there will always be missteps along the way, and we should not be expecting perfection out of scientists at all. My feeling is that if everything always worked out exactly the way scientists expected, they aren't trying enough. They're not asking hard enough questions. So we need to recognize that failure is actually a very important part of science. What I focus on is the failures that are unnecessary, that if people took more care with, for example, using the cell lines that they were using in their laboratories to make sure that they are actually breast cancer cell lines, not melanoma cell lines, which unfortunately happens a lot, that scientists have been fooled by the cells that they're studying and wrong about their identities. Just by dealing with some of those issues, they don't cost a lot more money to deal with, but they really will make science more productive. And I think also really what would help would be if the expectations were different and scientists could be told, we want you to publish less stuff, fewer studies, but we want them to be higher quality. I think that if that message could permeate science, that would help a lot. I think that it's it would seem counterproductive at first to think, well, if we're publishing less, that we're making fewer advances. But actually, if you're publishing less, but it's of higher quality, I actually think it would have the opposite effect.
Richard, we just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to just ask you quickly. You mentioned this just a minute ago. You make an important philosophical distinction at the beginning of your book that science is about observing and drawing conclusions, but oftentimes we can make errors based on the wrong judgment or prevailing paradigms that turn out to be incorrect. And I wonder, did you learn anything in the course of writing this that made you change your thinking on this topic?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, among other things, I realized that a lot of what we journalists have been putting out, the study of the week out of medical journals and science journals, I'm much more cautious about overinterpreting.
Reporting
them.
On, yeah. Especially if it's Nature, Science,
yeah.
Or Cell.
I mean, there's still good and interesting things being published in those journals. But I think that we need to be aware that science is a less perfect process than maybe we've given it credit for. Partly due to human error, partly due to the fact that it's tough, and we should not be overselling these results either as journalists. So that was the big take home message. It's hard for a journalist, all of a sudden it's like, oh, I don't want to do that story because I think that, I see some problems with it, and then you could just sit on your hands and do nothing if you take that too far in extreme. But or actually, what I've been trying to do is focus on longer term taking the big picture, the long view of stuff, as opposed to focusing so much on the study of the week. I learned a tremendous amount by taking this year of reflection and conversation about these topics that touch us all.
Right. And maybe good advice for all of us, too, when we look at as news consumers and our listeners are looking at things, we shouldn't really jump immediately to these news study changes, everything kind of headlines as well.
Exactly.
Thanks so much for joining us. Richard Harris is NPR science correspondent. He's also the author of Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hopes, and Wastes Billions. Again, he's speaking this afternoon at the Spurlock Museum if you're in Urbana in the central Illinois area. And speaking of scientific research, coming up, we're going to be talking about a very big announcement that just happened an hour ago in Chicago about the University of Illinois expanding into a satellite campus in Chicago. University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen is going to be joining us in a few minutes. Richard, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is the 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. This morning, Governor Rauner joined Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen to announce the creation of a satellite campus for the U of I in downtown Chicago.
Our number one goal must be to have the University of Illinois expand its impact, expand its opportunity here within the state of Illinois, so its students, its faculty, its researchers, its entrepreneurs have an opportunity to build their businesses here. Here in downtown Chicago, here in Urbana-Champaign, here in Rockford, here in Peoria, here in Springfield.
That's Governor Bruce Rauner just about an hour ago in downtown Chicago. The Discovery Partners Institute is meant to be a hub between Chicago entrepreneurs, the University of Illinois, Northwestern, and the University of Chicago. It'll be located on part of a 62-acre site along the Chicago River, just south of Roosevelt Road, being developed by Related Midwest. The developers are donating a parcel to the project. I spoke with University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen before the announcement this past hour. President Killeen, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me this morning.
What can you tell us about the Institute? What programs will be represented at this Discovery Institute?
Well, we're very excited, of course, at the announcement this morning that's going to take place within the next hour or so. It's long term in planning, but we've thought through the initial themes that the Institute will be focusing on. And they relate to health and wellness, big data, computational, predictive analytics, and food and agriculture as sort of important arenas where there are, you know, significant societal challenges that we need to bring our brain trust together to confront and address, and for which we have a particular expertise. And there's a lot of interest in the business community to have this kind of strong and vibrant partnership with research-intensive university partners that are part of this. So it's those are the initial themes. I would imagine that they will grow to encompass many other areas. We're talking to a lot of business partners who have interest in many sectors. I would say most sectors of the economy that's represented in Illinois. So it will grow and extend. And of course, the directions will be set in large part by the aspirations and the energy of our great faculty who will be driving this program and really co-designing it with others in partnership.
And what kind of faculty base do you envision at this institute? How many positions?
Well, we're going to at full elaboration. We're imagining something like 90 to 100 new faculty expressly recruited for this effort. They will have their tenured homes in at the U of I system or one of our partner institutions. But in addition to that, we will have current faculty and existing faculty and new recruits just to the universities that will be participating. And of course, the plans involve students. spending 1 to 4 semesters at the institute itself and gaining access to experience, hands-on work, so that, you know, there'll be a tremendous number of students who will every year participate. So I would say hundreds of faculty, including 90 to 100 brand new, specially recruited, world-class faculty.
On that point of faculty, President Killeen, I'm not sure if you saw the Atlantic Magazine article this week that looks at faculty at public doctoral universities and their wages, you know, already making about 25% less than counterparts at private institutions. And then when you look at professors at public universities in Illinois, they earn significantly less than their colleagues on the West Coast, much less, 28% less than those in the Northeast. How is the university trying to retain faculty, especially when it just comes to the money portion? How do you think endeavors like the Discovery Institute will help that?
Oh, this will help enormously. And as you know, we've come through a two-year budget situation that really did not allow us to maintain market pressures in the faculty. So we have dropped a couple of percent, I'd say, at the University of Illinois system, which we're committed to rectifying and doing it quickly now that we have a budget. We have a procurement reform, which for us is a major step forward as well. It's very motivating to the faculty to be able to do things quickly and in an agile fashion. So, and now with this announcement, I think we're going to be a special magnet for talent. We clearly want to be, way up there in terms of our compensation programs for the kind of talent that we want to recruit and attract. And of course, Illinois is a wonderful place to live and work and raise a family. So we've got other aspects as well in that recruitment package. So I can assure you, we're going to be very aggressive in this recruitment. We've already started. We've already got a distinguished faculty recruitment program where we've pulled together $60 million to initiate recruitment of this kind of star faculty. So there are many things we have to offer, but we want to have a competitive compensation package as well.
And how would all of this be funded, as you mentioned, that $60 million?
Well, those funds come from the university, and that's just the first step that we've taken a month or two ago to make that announcement. Now, with the announcement of the DPI, we can rev that up, as you might imagine. Most of the funding for this will come from philanthropic sources and from industry and businesses, but we're anticipating as well there'll be state and city interest. This is, after all, something that's going to really help the state build its tax base and the city of Chicago be even more of a magnet to incoming businesses that might want to relocate here and new business startups that can flow out of this. So all of that is part of the thinking of the DPI.
And when you mentioned private industry in the state, let's start with private industry. In particular, are there particular partners or industries that you can name that have already lined up to back this initiative?
Well, we have, I put in place shortly after my arrival what we call the CEO Roundtable, and it's had very strong visionary leadership from, I'd say, to 12 to 15 CEOs of Illinois-based companies. They would include State Farm, Northern Trust, Caterpillar, Health Services Corporation, those kind of companies. So we've had conversations with them. We know that Tom Siebel of one of our most successful alumnus is very interested as well. So I don't think there'll be a lack of interest, but we're not in a position to name specific industrial partners as yet. This is the beginning, though. Look for additional announcements down the road.
And I know from the state funding, I know there's been some reports that Governor Rauner hasn't gotten backing from state lawmakers yet to fund this. So I wonder, have you been in discussions? Have you introduced this to House Speaker Madigan or Senate President Cullerton? Have you talked to them about this initiative?
There have been many discussions over the last more than a year or so, and some of those conversations are ongoing. We're not today going to be announcing the specifics of
of the state and city involvement, but we are very excited at the property that we're actually sitting at right now at this moment, with the beautiful Chicago skyline and a lovely day. That's going to be the first concrete announcement of a donation. More will follow, though.
When's the timeline for when all of this can happen, then?
Well, we're looking at the implementation planning effort right now. We expect to have the full plan elaborated by 2018, and then initiation and the full DPI will be established by we are planning for 2022. Now, I want to mention quickly that the DPI is only a component. It's a major central component of what we're calling the Illinois Innovation Network, or IIN, which we're also going to be announcing today, which will extend across the whole state with important nodes at Rockford, Peoria, Urbana-Champaign, and in the southern region, the Quad Cities, etc. So this is going to be a virtually connected innovation network with the DPI as the central Chicago-based node. So the plans go beyond just the elaboration of this institute that we're announcing today to include this network, and there'll be other partners associated with that development as well. And of course, our extension services will be a component of that too, because they already have a statewide presence.
So when you say virtual presence, that means you'll be collaborating with institutions or businesses in Rockford or Peoria or both?
Yes, we expect to help develop, as is appropriate for a land-grant university system like ours, regionally tailored economic development nodes. We're calling them nodes, where our students can participate and work with the local or regional business community in close partnership. And by virtually connected, a lot of this is going to be driven by what you might call or think of as IT collaboration. We have a fantastic network in Illinois. We're blessed with that. We have a computer science infrastructure that is remarkable. We have the ability to simulate, to visualize, to transfer large data sets and do data mining, all of the things that many of these, and that's almost a universal tool for the 21st century economy, which will then be expressed regionally as well as in the world city of Chicago. So that's what I mean by virtually connected, that we're going to be heavily utilizing our prowess, I would say, in information technology and in computational science. As the governor points out, we graduate 10% of all the computer scientists in the country, and so we have a great strength in that area, which is going to be a very important asset to bring to bear.
And the idea, hoping that we'll retain those graduates to stay in Illinois with initiatives like this?
Yes, that's a big part of our thinking. As you may know, and your listeners may know, we lose net 16,000 high schoolers, college ready high schoolers, to adjacent states, and when they leave Illinois, we only see about 30% of them return to Illinois. So that's a net drain of human capital. We want to attract those college ready talented students to Illinois universities. We want to keep them. We want to give them a world-class education that will have this very special opportunity to really interact in this innovation space. And then when they graduate, we want to make sure that they have opportunities to either become entrepreneurs themselves and start companies, or participate in other activities, small, medium, large companies, to help job creation and to retain our talent. I think, speaking personally, this is what the state needs to build its tax base up. We need to take advantage of all of our assets, and most important among those are the human capital assets that we have for our talented youth. And so that's of course what we're all about at the University of Illinois system, and this provides just another dimension for that experience, which I think will be beneficial in keeping talent in state. And that's what's needed in the long run.
That's University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen on this announcement this morning. Lots of announcements happening today, all part of this Illinois Innovation Network. President Killeen, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for your interest.
2-1 the count. Bellinger hits it hard. Got a chance to turn it here. 4-6-3 And a double play! And the ball game is over! The Cubs win! And there will be a game five.
That's Brian Anderson on TBS calling the final seconds of last night's Cubs versus Dodgers League Series Game 4. Javi Baez, who hit two home runs in that game, fielded the beginning of that double play to help the Cubs manage to pull out a win and stay alive to play again tonight. Tonight, of course, is another must-win for the Cubs with the National League Championship Series at 3-1. That game's going to be at Wrigley Field in Chicago tonight. It's going to be a tough one for the Cubs, who are going up against Dodgers pitcher Clayton Kershaw, arguably one of the best pitchers in MLB history. So let's go Cubs, and we're hoping we're going to have another chance to play that song again in this postseason. That does it for us today. You can always find our past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, whether you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. It's all at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, you can search for The 21st and like us. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can post questions, message us about anything you want to talk to us about with our on-air production. We're produced by Alan Montesilio, Bob Holly, and Robin Lynn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.